And ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to the voice of Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes. The world won't get any better if we just let it be. Wake up, everybody. We are calling all the teachers, all the doctors, all the professors, all the experts, all the bright minds. Ladies and gentlemen, it is time for our featured segment, and it is called Mic Check. Sparking global changes, ladies and gentlemen. Apartheid, ladies and gentlemen, will be the conversation this morning. What was apartheid? It was a system of institutionalized racial segregation that actually existed in South Africa and Southwest Africa from 1948 until the early 1990s. I'm not sure if it's not still going on, but how dangerous and how damaging this was to black and black people and people of color. We will ask that question to, yes indeed, Associate Professor of African and African American Studies Program at New Jersey City University. Yes indeed, Dr. Jermaine McCaplin has now joined us. Good morning, Dr. Caplin. How are you?
I'm good, Raslim. Good to be on. It's been a while, but good to be on.
It's been a while. And you know why it's been a while, Doc? You are a traveling man. I understand that you just came back from Africa. And it brings me to this disturbing thing that took place in South Africa. Right. But before we even get to the meat of the matter, no, the fish of the matter, because I don't eat meat. Before we get to the fish of the matter this morning, or the veggie of the matter this morning, how was your trip to the continent, first and foremost?
It was good, you know. It mm-hmm. wasn't really vacation, it was research. I was mm-hmm. in Burundi, which is essentially in East Africa, mm-hmm. East Central Africa, and we were doing research on genocide. Most people will know of Rwanda, the neighboring country, but Burundi is one of the five countries in what we call the Great Lakes region of Africa. So that mm-hmm. includes Tanzania, Rwanda, Burundi, Uganda.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yes, so we were there doing research.
Indeed, indeed, indeed. Well, you know, Doc, you're always researching, and it's just so fitting that you just came back from the continent. And this morning, we would like to take a look of, you know, and I know that
sure.
I know that many folks may be wondering, why are we taking a look at this racist system, this segregated system that lasted for so long and probably still happening
right.
to a certain degree, apartheid, and
right.
let's start. What was really this? Because some will say that this is true racism because it was studied. That's what they're saying. Talk to us about this.
All right, so Russ, some context is required, you know, because mm-hmm. I want the listeners to be aware as to the historical context and connection to the U.S. Mm-hmm. Yes, to mm-hmm. the U.S. So let me get to the historical context. The word apartheid is from the Africana word, which means apartness or separateness. Mm-hmm. And surprise, surprise, ding, 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 it was actually modeled after Jim Crow racial segregation in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
So we know that Jim Crow was established in the U.S. starting in the late 1880s into the early 1890s
mm-hmm.
after the Plessy versus Ferguson ruling.
Mm-hmm.
So the framers of apartheid were actually looking at the U.S. and its Jim Crow segregation when it designed this system called apartheid. Mm-hmm. Now, to be clear, there are two European-based groups in South Africa, the British
mm-hmm.
and the descendants of the Dutch, who we call Afrikaner, or they were previously called the Boer, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the Boer, we know from Shaka Zulu in the late 1800s, fought against the Zulu people
mm-hmm.
for control of lands in South Africa. So why is this system so consequential? It was based on racist legislation that preceded even the founding of the system in 1948. So to be clear,
mm-hmm.
I don't want the listeners to think that there was no racism in South Africa mm-hmm. before 1948.
Mm-hmm.
The British, however, were in control of government until 1948.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the British, born Europeans that laid the foundation for the apartheid state. How did they do that? And I'll give you something that may shock you and the listeners. In 1913, There was an act called the Native Lands Act. It was passed in 1913, often called the Black Lands Act. Why was it called the Black Lands Act? Because it prohibited, legally prohibited, blacks from owning lands outside a very small part of South Africa. Mm-hmm. What it meant, essentially, was that blacks could not control lands outside of very small and constricted geographic areas in South Africa. Mm-hmm. That's one. Mm-hmm. Two, they would not be able to lease land in areas that were white. This mm-hmm. is almost 35 years before apartheid, and so I want it to be clear. So this happened mm-hmm. in 1913. Mm-hmm. But it is the third part of the legislation that was critical, mass relocation, mm-hmm. because it meant now that blacks would have to now be quarantined into certain areas. Mm-hmm. Hence, this was a prelude 30 plus years before apartheid took effect. Mm-hmm. Now, what did that mean, essentially? That it enshrined white ownership of land. And so, as per the Native Lands Act of 1913, mm-hmm. up to when South Africa had its first democratic elections between April 26 and April 29, 1994, mm-hmm. 87% of land in South Africa is white-owned. Whites make up less than 20% of the total population of South Africa. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to understand that legislation, though the act was repealed. So to be clear, mm-hmm. the act stood from 1913 until 1991. So though the act was repealed, it has not in its wake led to black land ownership. So all the sound and fury about whites fearing repossession of land, this goes back to the historical context of the Native Lands Act. And it is more a myth than reality that they're going to en masse lose these lands. Though, if we were to go back to the reality that so much of these lands were dispossessions from blacks, then we get to understand that in South Africa, one of the big issues in South Africa at the end of apartheid was the question of land and land redistribution.
Wow. The danger and the damage of apartheid in South Africa. But you know, Professor, and you just said something that is it's just ringing in my head. And why is this ringing in my head? I am going to go to Palestine and I'm going to go to Jamaica because what we just saw and what we are seeing happening and what we are hearing about what the U.S. wants to do with the Palestinian is getting them off Gaza and taking over Gaza, taking over the people's land, displacing them. And then in Jamaica, I remember the Morant Bay Rebellion, and it was said that Paul Bogle was one of our national heroes, and he actually was fighting for blacks to be able to own land in Jamaica. And this is just ringing in my head that you mentioned Jim Crow. It means that the architects of apartheid actually came to the U.S. and it looked like they studied the system here and they use it to their advantage back in Africa.
They certainly did, but there's one thing that I left out that would be very important for our listeners to know, because we will know. Everyone has heard of the Rhodes Scholarship, right? Mm-hmm. Prestigious scholarship okay. So the minister that brought the Native Lands Act to Parliament in 1913 was none other than the progenitor of the scholarship, Cecil John Rhodes, and his associate. So he pioneered the Native Lands Act in South Africa.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, Professor, the damage is already done. This was a very...
But I want to go back to what you were saying, Inaras. I want to address this question of land.
Please.
So Malcolm X said, every revolution that has ever been fought is about land. Mm-hmm. Either the lack of or someone redistributing land. Mm-hmm. And he said, go back to any revolution, French, American, Russian, Chinese, any revolution you go to, it's about land. The American War of Independence, the American Revolution was about what? This land here in the United States, right? Mm-hmm. Every revolution has been about land. Mm-hmm. And after enslavement formally ended in Jamaica, mm-hmm. the question of landlessness was not as a result of lack of land. It was direct and explicit that the quote black majority would always be landless. Mm-hmm. And so even when we have these contemporary disruptions in Jamaica about squatting and informal settlement, the reality of it is that so much of our lands is still crown lands owned by the British crown. Mm-hmm. And so when we talk about land and landlessness, it is not a lack of available arable land. It is a question of ownership. So there was never any mass transfer of lands to the quote landless population. Mm-hmm. What our respective governments have done is essentially provided housing solutions without ever giving people the opportunity or the likelihood of owning land. And so even the question of land in the Middle East is a question, again, of ownership and independence. You cannot talk about independence of any group of people without land.
You know, you mentioned crown lands in Jamaica. And I've been saying this for the umpteen years that I've been on radio. I've been talking about what kind of independence Jamaica got in 1962. And that was only political independence. I talk about the Morant Bay Rebellion led by national hero Paul Bogle and why he was fighting. And, you know, this whole thing about land and the crown land situation in Jamaica once again came to the forefront when the government of Jamaica decided that they were going to sell some farmlands, prime farmlands, in Bernard Lodge, and they were going to sell it to mm-hmm. Michael Lee Chin. And once again, you heard about these were crown lands. And then you're saying to yourself, after 62 years of political independence, crown lands still exist in Jamaica, to the point where folks are living on land in Jamaica that they don't even have mm-hmm. a title for, because it is still under crown ownership. Now, isn't that a sad situation? Because, you know, when they say we should pull ourselves up by our bootstraps, and as Martin Luther King said, how do you tell a bootless man to pull himself or mm-hmm. herself up by the bootstrap? This is a very dangerous and damaging thing that they have done to us as humans, huh?
Yes, I think one of the things that we often don't focus on, you know, when I give talks about independence, I make a distinction between independence and emancipation, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Though we think of political and then freedom. So independence, right? Independence is the formal end of submission to a larger power, mm-hmm. right? So you have mm-hmm. a flag, you get an anthem, mm-hmm. You get a currency. Mm-hmm. But freedom means that you have the ability to direct the course of action that determines your sovereignty. Mm-hmm. Most of us have political independence, but we ultimately don't have freedom in many of these countries in the global south, mm-hmm. because we either have a direct or indirect connection to the previous colonizers mm-hmm. or to a global international political and financial system that inserts us into an inferior position. Mm-hmm. So when you talk about independence, let's be clear that this was a transfer of power.
Right.
The formal end to British rule, and it was a transfer of power. There was not a revolutionary there. Mm-hmm. And I'm not dismissing or diminishing the fact that we could now domesticate our political leaders, etc. But what has that political leadership, what has that polity done to transform the reality of the average Jamaican life? Mm. When you think about the fact, the question of land, we can't move beyond the question of land. Because when you travel Jamaica, when I travel Jamaica, when you see the length and breadth and you see hundreds of acres, and I always wonder, who owns this?
Yeah, yeah. I always wonder
who owns this? And so much of it is parochial land, meaning that it is owned by, you know, many of the church societies and fellowships, right?
Indeed.
Because of how many of these church societies acquired land mm-hmm. under the sponsorship of the British colonial government, yeah. right? The Baptist, the Moravia, mm-hmm. etc. Mm-hmm. But then you think of crown lands, including that large swath of land on which King's House rests. Mm-hmm. All of that is not owned by the government of Jamaica, but by the British Crown.
It is indeed a very serious and dangerous situation. Another thought-provoking conversation here on Grooving Radio, right here on Irie Jam Radio. We are in our featured segment, Mic Check, Sparking Global Changes. Apartheid is the conversation this morning. It was a system of institutional racial segregation in South Africa and Southwest Africa from 1948. As a matter of fact, it started before then, but I guess the documentation says 1948 to the early 1990s.
Yes, the formal start.
Right. And we're having a conversation this morning with no other than Associate Professor of African and African American Studies Program at New Jersey City University, Dr. Jermaine McAlpin, ladies and gentlemen. I want to stay in Jamaica for a moment, Doc. I want to stay in Jamaica for a moment because oftentimes I used to wonder myself when I drive across Jamaica and I look at these the acres and acres of lands and I see where entities like Black Rock has now landed in Jamaica and is doing development in Jamaica. I oftentimes tell my friends and family that the colonizers, some of them who never left, and the ones who are coming back today, they're coming back as investors. And Jamaicans and Caribbean nationals should be very aware of what's happening and what has happened in Jamaica. Because if we still, to a certain degree, and if you look at redlining, mm-hmm. even here in the United States, we can probably say we had redlining in Jamaica because Bakra was the only one who was allowed to buy certain lands or own certain lands in Jamaica. We were kind of put in a box. Would you say that? Mm-hmm. Put in a box and put in a little corner. And that is where they kept us for many years. And they're keeping us there.
Hmm? Yes, but you see, one of the things to clarify, and this is how history does, that over time, mm-hmm. almost all the free village settlements that happened in the wake of emancipation, the formal emancipation and the end of enslavement, the free villages, where almost all of them were, in the hills.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And a century and a half, almost two centuries later, the, quote, landless people are now on the plains, the flats. Mm-hmm. And we now have a residential kind of inversion where the privileged and the wealthy and the landed are now in the hills, mm-hmm. while the poor and landless are now on the plains. Mm-hmm. If you look across Jamaica and you look generally, especially in the corporate area, Kingston, St. Andrew, the hills are the repository of those who are privileged, who have land. Mm-hmm. And so we continue to talk about the National Housing Trust, mm-hmm. but maybe that should be expanded to talk about the National Land Trust. We have a national land agency, mm-hmm. but it's not designed to allocate or reallocate land. Mm-hmm. I hear statistics such as that 40% of Jamaicans live on land that they don't own, mm-hmm. right? So we're talking about, I don't like to use the word squatter because it is a pejorative and derogatory term, mm-hmm. Simply because in many instances, through no fault of their own, people have lived on lands, but there has never been any formalization mm-hmm. Of ownership. And many lands are unoccupied and, you know, eminent or kind of adversarial possession. But the fact is, our governments have never done anything to address the land problem. They have done mm-hmm. is to provide housing mm-hmm. solutions, but there's no land that the people can ever dream of owning. Because if you don't have any dead left land or your grandmother leaving any land mm-hmm. in country, where are you going to buy land from?
But you know, Professor, and they say they're providing housing. What kind of housing are they providing? Because news came last year that some of these housing that the government claim it is providing for those who are less fortunate, they don't even own these houses. it is said that when you see the government handing over keys, and it's only keys they're handing over, you know, they're not getting a title. And we have to ask these questions. Why aren't they being given a title? We have to question these things. And we have to
But what housing are you talking about, Russ? You're talking those through the social housing program?
Yes.
Or you're talking when people buy houses through NHT?
No, the social housing program that we see all over the news, and you see where the Prime Minister go and, you know, deliver a key to Rasclem and deliver a key to Jermaine, and we feel, yes, it's a house. It's a house, but who really owned those houses? You know, and then you look at how the National Housing Trust is run. Look at how the National Housing Trust is run. And look at the billions and billions of dollars that they get. And then you saw where they're using housing trust money to do other things in Jamaica and do a lot of government programs in Jamaica. So it just makes you wonder, are these people really, really trying to keep us down? Are they really trying to suppress us to the point where we may just finally say we're just going to give up one day, you know? We're just going to give up. But I want to go back to the continent also. And I want to talk about...
So let me just clarify one thing, because I don't want it to be said that, you know, the distinction is that in the new social housing programs, the houses are built on lands that the person who the house is built for has some legitimate claim. So they can't, so ultimately they can't hand over a title because the title is related to the land and not to the house.
Okay.
So I just wanted to clarify.
All right. All right, good.
For our listeners.
Thank you very much, sir. Thank you. Now, we want to go back to the continent. And we want to, what has changed really since the 1990s? How much has this whole segregation and racism changed on the continent of, as a matter of fact, South Africa? How much has it changed in South Africa?
South Africa, right. So that's where I did my doctoral research. And so having traveled there and, you know, researched there, in many instances, when you look around, what you see, and this was always the fear, that would be able to have political power, but economic power would remain entrenched in the hands of whites. So like I indicated, 75 to 80% of the land in South Africa are owned by whites, whether African or British, right? South Africa had four distinct racial categories under apartheid, right? Whites lumped together, then Bantu to describe Africans, and then coloreds, a distinct group of descendants from Cape Malay, and not just a mix of black and white, as coloreds would be called elsewhere, and then Asians, right? And of those four groups, blacks have the lowest level of ownership and the highest level of poverty.
Right.
As a matter of fact, if you look at the status of blacks in South Africa, they would look like any other underdeveloped country. If you look at the GDP per capita of whites, it looks more like Western Europe. So when you hear the sound and the fury about their possible oppression and the need for flight from South Africa because their lands are going to be taken, noise in the market, to the extent that if you look at the re-entrenchment of wealth, there was no massive transfer of wealth either in the context of economic opportunities or of land to blacks post-apartheid. And that is part of the reason why ANC lost so much of its support, because blacks are looking and saying, we have been patient, and after 31 years, we have not seen the needle move towards any of these things, because in South Africa, land is real. There was a recommendation from their Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and there was a National Lands Commission to settle questions of land redistribution. Most of the cases that have been brought to it have been settled, but there are almost 30% of those cases have not been settled. And so what we have is a reportage that is skewed towards making this expropriation act, which some are reading as if it is now going to just start a massive land seizure of white farms, white-owned farms, And so what we have is this kind of hysteria related to it, because ultimately that is not the spirit and intention of the Expropriation Act.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And so in many ways, this act was from 2024. So it's not like it's this year it's signed. It was from 2024.
Right.
And what does it talk about? It is repealing the apartheid era expropriation act of 1975. So there was a previous expropriation act, right? And it includes provisions for both compensation and potential. New compensation in certain circumstances. So ultimately, what the act is about is compensation is required for expropriated property.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, we are back. We are back to the conversation here on Groovin' Radio. You're listening to Groovin' Radio, and we are now continuing our presentation on ReggaeKingRadio.com, 92.5 FM in Bergen County, New Jersey, 98.9 FM, Future FM in the Bronx, Mount Vernon, New Rochelle, and Lower Westchester County area, GroovinRadioNY.com, IslandFlavorRadio.com. We're also live on the Tony Culture Time app and the WB Radio app. Ask Alessia to play Future FM, and this is where we are right now, ladies and gentlemen. Our conversation about this segregation system, this racist system that was in South Africa and probably still in South Africa and parts of the other places on the continent, apartheid. Our very, very special guest this morning is no other than a man who have studied. He have studied the entire Africa. Well, I say the African studies, and he's an associated professor at the New Jersey City University, Dr. Jermaine McAlpin, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back, Doc. Welcome back.
Hey, man. Thanks much. You know, yeah. One of the things that I wanted us to touch on based on the point you made is the similarity of the Expropriation Act to what obtains in the U.S. You see, and sometimes we trouble people place and we don't look on ours because in the U.S., the federal, state, or municipal government can enact eminent domain.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Expropriation is essentially the same thing. So, again, when people hear it and the emotional response is to say, but how could this happen? You're going to take people off land. You can just simply search eminent domain at any city, state, or federal level, and you will see that the government has the right to possess lands that it seeks to do so in the interest of the public, however the public is defined, whether or not you want to sell, to build highways, to build structures, all of these things happen. And so there's that part of the expropriation that is being focused on, that the government has the right and reserves the right to possess land, mostly with compensation. And the only ones that have nil compensation in the Expropriation Act in South Africa is those that essentially are lands used exclusively for recreational purposes. They wouldn't do nil compensation for land that people live on and for land that is livable land in terms of farms, etc. So I know that most people who are alarmed about the act have not necessarily looked at the letter of the act, have focused on maybe the potential use of the act without looking on the letter of the law. And so if we were to be honest and look at eminent domain legislation here in the U.S., it is no different.
You know, I'm happy that you brought that up, you know, because when you look at how they use eminent domain here to build highways, to build mini cities. When I say mini cities, if you look at what's even taking place in some part of Queens as we speak right now, like next next to City Field and those places, that is what they're using to get rid of those businesses and some of those people that are on some lands over there close to City Field, eminent domain. Now, Professor, when you look at governments being elected around the world these days, and I probably can go back to, let's say 2016 and coming forward, when you look at some of these right-wing governments that have been elected, when you look at some of these countries that are labeled communist countries, and you look at how they're treating so-called non-white folks, you look at how they're treating blacks, you look at how they're treating Indians, you look at how they're treating Asians, and I mean, just look right here in the United States of America, and you see the current administration, and how even yesterday in Washington, D.C., you saw the rollback in some civil rights programs. What are these guys, what are these guys really telling us? What are these folks really telling us? That they're trying to make this place so-called white again? Is that what they're telling us?
It's a part of the reality is that when people say elections have consequences, and most times we think that we individualize our choice, and we don't collectivize our choice, because if the gains of the civil rights movement, if it was about individual choice and individual abilities and individual opportunities, would have not had many of the advances that happened in the civil rights era, right? So you have to think of everything as collective action, Bama will say collective security for surety, right? Mm-hmm. That is what you have to do in the rat race. Mm-hmm. So when we do individual futures and say, okay, I am okay, so I don't need to vote according to X or Y or according to... Listen, when they say, if somebody, when Maya Angelou said, if someone show you who they are, believe them, most people never took it serious because they didn't look at the document. Mm-hmm. That 922-page document called Project 2025 is almost the playbook that is being utilized now.
Yes,
and I'm not even exaggerating. Mm-hmm. Almost 2/3 of the executive orders, they are found implied or explicit on the pages of that document, 922 pages, and you don't have to search very far to find them. They're in the first 70 to 80 pages, and the rest is spelling out extensively of what is to happen. The dismantling of the Department of Education, the dismantling of DEI, the dismantling of anything that appears to, and we have made woke a bad word, we have made woke a negative word, we've made woke a problematic word. All of this is happening because people are looking not on the reality of what are the consequences of electoral choice. This is not a Democrat or Republican thing. This is the point that all of these gains, including honoring those who fought for the humanity of people irrespective of color, all of those gains are essentially going to be reversed, because what you are now saying, if states now determine the right to govern education, we could really go back in many southern states to the fact that Ruby Bridges may be the only black person in a school, and would have to go under protection in order to go there. The first black to register for the University of Mississippi, and how he would have to be escorted by troops in order to go to school.
Right.
You see, that is not as far-fetched as we used to think.
Yeah.
Because what we are doing is that we are doing a throwback. We are going back to an era where the color of one's skin and not the content of one's character is the basis on which we judge. So we are actually having a reversion and a regression away from Martin Luther King's dream expressed to us on August 28, 1963. So we are going back to be judged by the color of our skin.
Yes, Professor. Could it be that we are now facing a constitutional crisis? Because, I mean, this current administration have used executive power, executive orders to actually roll back many things. They don't even want to answer to the laws of the country. They don't even want to answer to federal judges today, Professor. So is America afraid of itself? Is America really at that point? Because as we look at South Africa and we look at racism and we bring it and we bring it closer to home and we bring it back to here, are we looking at Jim Crow? Could we be looking at Jim Crow 2.0?
You know, years ago, and I'm glad that he had said it years ago, Reverend Barber, James Barber, he said Jim Crow went to law school and changed his persona, and he's now James Crow Esquire, but he's still the same Jim Crow. I never forgot that analogy when he said it. He said he's now James Crow Esquire. So law is now going to be used as a basis of reverting us to a time prior to the dawn of the civil rights era. Because when we think about it, we are now saying this idea of race neutrality, of everything neutral, and we are not seeing color. And I keep saying to people that when we do that, it doesn't make us any higher or morally sound than anyone else. It means that we're in denial because we are diverse and we are different, right? Mm-hmm. And so this idea now of sameness through legislation, to be clear, the abolition of the Department of Education would require a two-third majority in the Senate. So I don't see it happening. He would need 60 senators for that to have any likelihood, and I can't see that happening. So the larger question is, the larger question we must ask ourselves is, what is to be our response? Because part of it is that I have heard people say it's almost like they're you know, that way you're going for the night, so you've settled in to just ride it out for 4 years. But it's not just a riding out for 4 years. We have to hold our elected officials accountable to challenging and opposing these things legislatively. That's why Congress is there. Congress now, we used to talk about the second term of a president being a lame duck president if he's had two consecutive terms. Mm-hmm. But Congress is looking very lame duck right now because we are not getting the sound and the fury. We're not getting the fire. We're not getting the opposition to many of these kinds of things. Mm-hmm. We are getting more reportage about what executive orders signed, but we have not heard any pushback, blowback, beatback, or any such thing from Congress, from those people who have been elected across the United States. Because to be clear, the outcome of the elections would indicate that upwards of 40%+ of Americans thought Donald Trump was the better choice, right? But everyone, irrespective of who you voted for, will have to abide by the consequences. You think the people are being targeted, even if they voted for him, they are suffering. Because many of those people who lost jobs were people who voted for him as president. But all of us are going to be affected, and that is why we can't now say, okay, well, I didn't vote for him, but all of us will have to stand by the consequences.
Indeed, indeed. And you know, the damage is already done. You talk about Project 2025, which the current president tried to distance himself from. But if you look within his administration, what you're seeing now, Professor, is that a lot of those folks who were the architect of Project 2025, they're actually working for this current president. Now, you talk about pushback and blowback. There is some pushback taking place. But the way the media is being controlled by these folks now, you're not seeing what some of these black Congress people are doing because it's not being highlighted. There's a lot of pushback that is taking place in Congress, but because the current administration controls the Supreme Court, they control the White House, they control the Senate, and they control the Congress, and they have gone on to control the media, they have gone on to control education, they have gone on now to control the businesses and everything. So we're in a very peculiar position. You also mentioned that all elections have consequences. Once again, I've been saying this for years, that every single election has consequences. Local election have national implications. So when we sit around and says we're not voting, when we sit around and says, I didn't vote for that individual, well, guess what? The Roman circus is now in full swing. How do we respond to this, Professor? How do we?
It's a part of it is that, yes, I've seen the pushback from black and brown, members of Congress. But the larger question is not just a congressional pushback. Mm-hmm. So many of us have just resigned ourselves to the fate that these things will happen, and we're hoping that whomever comes to power 4 years from now will revert some of them. But the damage, if you think of that, mm-hmm. 4 years of this kind of damage and what it will take to revert them, right? Mm-hmm. It will take maybe another generation to change many of the things there.
Indeed.
Because when we think about what the civil rights movement meant, and there are many criticisms we can offer vis-a-vis the civil rights movement, mm-hmm. Focusing as it of necessity had to focus on civil and political rights, some would argue in the interest of economic justice, right? That's another conversation. Mm-hmm. But those gains, if you want to imagine, just look at all the legislation, the equal employment opportunity, all of these civil rights legislations that were initiated under JFK and because of his assassination were essentially signed into law by Lyndon Johnson.
From
64 and 65, the Voting Rights Act, the Civil Rights Act. All of these things we have been told every election cycle that in many parts of the U.S. they were under threat. Mm-hmm. Now many of these people have been emboldened to make these threats more than a threat and to make them a reality, because many of these legislations will eventually be repealed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, like I said, the damage is already done. We were warned. This individual did not hide what he wanted to do, what he wanted to become. He told us exactly that he wanted to be a dictator, even for a day, but he didn't give us a date. And you see now where many of the folks who voted for him and who have now lost their jobs, and, you know, they're making a lot of noise about, we voted for you to make America so-called great again. Hitler did tell the folks in Germany that he was going to make Germany, quote unquote, great again, and we saw what happened. So you know, you folks went ahead and you did what you did, and now you're trying to reverse it. No. It is in full effect. It's in high gear. As we wrap, as we come closer to wrap this conversation.
Yes.
And you look at apartheid, and you look at racism here in America, you look at Jim Crow, and, you know, you look and see what is taking place today. Talk about the civil rights. We talk about the movements. We no longer have great leaders like Marcus Garvey. We no longer have the Martin Luther Kings and the Malcolm X. And, you know, we don't have a Nelson Mandela.
Harriet Tubman.
Shirley Chisholm. Yeah, we don't have any of those. Mm-hmm. if I go down to Jamaica and I look at some of our national heroes, I say, you know, and I'm going to single out the Paul Bogles and the Sam Sharp and the Nanny and all those folks. We don't have those leaders. What do we do? What do we do?
Well, it's a part of the challenge is that every era and every generation will have to determine how it will live and what will it offer for the future.
Mm-hmm.
I think in many instances we think of these historical figures as operating in times where they face particular challenges and situations, and they dealt with them. And we will just have to ensure that we mentor and encourage the current generations to emerge out of the shadow of doing nothing and become leaders. We don't have to be Paul Bogle, we don't have to be Shirley Chisholm or Sojourner Truth or Harriet Tubman or Malcolm X,
mm-hmm.
but we have to be willing to make a sacrifice for the purpose of our people, however we define people, whether by race, by religion, by economic status, by immigration status, because the reality of it, when Dr. King said injustice everywhere is a threat to justice anywhere, right?
Mm-hmm.
We have to realize that our collective survival depends on all of us coming together, because that was part of the problem of why we are here, mm-hmm. because people went towards self-interested. Oh, yes, deal with immigration strongly, but you forgot that people that look like you and some of the people who belong to your family would be deported.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, do this or law and order president, but then you are going to enact the will of the people by breaching the very constitution and legislative channels through which laws should be processed. The executive order has become the kind of way of governing, right? And the executive order was never designed to be an act of governance. It was designed to give the president the opportunity to impact, for the executive branch to impact the direction of legislation. It was never designed to be legislation itself.
You know, you mentioned earlier on that it may take a generation or two to even reverse some of the things that this current administration is doing. It seems as if executive orders have become orders of the day. We woke up this morning to the news that the president yesterday says that he's revoking legal status. Legal status, I'm talking about, for 530,000 Cubans, Haitians, Nicaraguans, and Venezuelans. We also woke up this morning to the news that the current president has now taken away security clearance for folks like Hillary Rodham Clinton. As a matter of fact, the Clintons, they're taking away security clearance for folks like former Vice President. Former Vice President is opponent, Kamala Harris. And then we also heard this week that you know, the president said that he's annulling the preemptive pardons issued by former President Joe Biden, you know, to members of Congress who actually investigated the January 6th insurrection. So we're waking up to all these madness, Professor, and yet still, after all these years, America is still a racist country.
You see, what I want people to understand, because we look at racism simply as the individual preferences of people. Racism is a global system of domination and oppression that combines three P's: power, privilege, and prejudice.
Wow.
So you can have someone that's just prejudicial. But you don't have power and you don't have privilege.
Right.
All of us have prejudices. But when you combine power, privilege, and prejudice, that is a system of domination and oppression that privileges some people over others, that gives power to some people and takes it from others, and where those who are privileged can operate in their prejudgment, right? Judging an entire set of people simply because of X or Y. Judging veterans, judging women, right? Judging blacks, judging non-English speakers. All of that is judgment, you know? Because I looked at the comparative assessment of executive orders since January 19th, 2025. We are not yet into three full months.
Right.
It's 93 executive orders that have been signed.
Wow.
Just to compare.
Wow.
In 2017 to 2021, when he was president at that time, it was 220 executive orders. And in less than 100 days, he has signed 93 already.
Wow. Wow.
Joe Biden signed 162 or 63 in his 4 years in office. So the executive order has become essentially the order of the day.
Yeah, yeah. Professor, Dr. Jermaine McAlpin, I thank you so much for joining the conversation this morning. I thank you so much for engaging with our listening audience. I'm just going to ask you for your closing remarks, sir. Go ahead.
You know, when we think of this situation in South Africa and the reality that after 31 plus years, the black majority in South Africa has functioned essentially as an economic minority in their own country because there has been no mass transfer of wealth as a result of democracy. It pauses and it causes us to pause that democracy in many instances can leave economic oppression entrenched. And we see that in South Africa, and we see that in the U.S., where the privileged continue to be more privileged. And while you may color the privilege of the privileged class by including specks and sprinkles of non-whites, the reality of it is that the majority of those who were oppressed under a system of apartheid continue to exist under an oppressive system, even if they now have the right to vote. They do not have the option to own lands or to transform themselves through generational wealth.
Wow.
And ultimately, that is the challenge in South Africa.
You know, Malcolm X used to say that democracy is like hypocrisy. and Malcolm X, it was just so profound. And folks, I just want you to pay attention to your surrounding. Pay attention to the Roman circus that is unfolding around us. And pay attention to what is germane to us. They know how to keep us distracted. And they have done a wonderful job. Yeah, I have to commend them. They have done a wonderful job doing so. But look how many have tried to open our eyes. Look how many prophets have tried to open our eyes. But some of us continue to be blinded. Take off the blindfolds, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you so much, Professor, for joining this conversation.
My pleasure.
Don't stay away for too long anymore. Don't stay away for too long anymore, Professor. We'll talk soon. Thank you so much.
Yeah, man. Blessings.
One love. Ladies and gentlemen, we have come to the end of our featured presentation. Mic check right here on Grooving Radio.